Hi, Khaled.
Hey, Bob. How are you? Good to be back.
I'm good. I'm not as busy as you are. You are the United Nations correspondent for Al Jazeera Television. I should say for our podcast listeners, you are Khaled Daoud, and I'm Bob Wright. And it's a very busy week for you there, right?
Yeah, it's been actually almost busy 2 weeks because probably this is the first General Assembly, which Mr. Ban Ki-moon takes responsibility for as the Secretary General. So probably he was really trying to make a lot of preparatory meetings on the main topics that were being discussed, at least maybe when the big leaders arrive, they could have agreement on the, or at least some sort of guidelines on the topics that they're going to talk about. So we had meetings about Iraq, we had meetings in Afghanistan, we had meetings about Sudan, we had meetings about climate change, and then came, of course, we also had some meetings about the quartet and the upcoming Middle East Peace Conference, which President Bush called for in November, and of course the big day, or what we call here the United Nations, the festival started on Tuesday when the presidents gave their speeches. Of course, President Bush was a matter of major concern, as usual. There was a new star this time, Mr. Sarkozy, Nicolas Sarkozy, the new French president. Everybody was following him, especially after the recent statements he made with his foreign minister on Iran. And, of course, the major source of attention was the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad, who was here. But those were basically many issues, many topics. We had the G8 meeting on Iran. So almost every topic that's like kind of a little bit hot these days. Of course, just as the GA was opening, we had these troubles going on in Burma. And we had the Bush speech mentioning that he wants some sort of an action by the Security Council in Burma. So that became another topic. So indeed, it was a very busy week. And still until today, actually, just, I mean, the minute before we started, I was trying to cover the speech by the Israeli Foreign Minister, Mrs. Tzipi Livni, to the General Assembly, and I think in an hour we're going to hear from the Syrian Foreign Minister, but the whole thing should wrap up probably by Wednesday, October 3rd.
So at any moment you may have to leave. When the Syrian speaks, you may have to go, I guess.
Well, the tradition, Bob, is that the GA started on Tuesday, they said that each president or leader or head of government should speak for 15 minutes. But of course, you know, nobody can tell the president to step down from the podium, and these guys go on forever.
Yeah.
They go on for half an hour, for 40 minutes. President Sarkozy of France, his speech was like 6 or 7 pages. The same for President Bush. Almost no leader, I think, kept his 15-minute limit. I'm sorry, I will just have to switch up my phone maybe. Okay.
Okay. So, and you think even if you
can we,
tell
can
them
we
that
pause
blogging
that for a second? Can we pause that for a second, Bob? I have to take this call.
Sure.
Yeah? Hello?
You're still talking to me, I think.
Alaykum salam wa barakatuh.
Oh.
Bob, it's really, I have to do something for quickly 2 minutes. Is that fine?
You mean 2 minutes right now?
Yeah.
You mean you need to call somebody?
No, I need to write something.
Oh, you need to write something?
Yes.
Oh, how long will that take?
2 minutes.
2 minutes?
Yes.
You're fast. Okay,
no.
Sure. Go ahead. Let's leave the camera rolling. I mean, we can cut it out, but you can might as well
I
leave
think
it rolling.
We should cut it out, you know, really. I don't know, except if you want it to be so lively live.
Reality TV has its virtues.
I forgot it was reality TV. Last time I thought you were going to do some editing of the funny faces I did. You did not.
No.
You know, you kept all the funny faces I made. I wasn't so whoops. Ready to go? Sorry about that.
That's okay. I was hoping to eavesdrop on your phone call, but I lost interest when I heard that it was in Arabic. I need to work on my Arabic. In America,
you don't want to know what they were asking me for.
What's that?
You don't want to know what they were asking me for.
I'd be happy to hear what they were asking you for.
Yeah, they were just asking me to send more material from the speech by the Israeli foreign minister because I was trying to get the job done quickly, and I sent them a small quotation, so they want a longer one, basically.
Did any big news come out of her talk?
I don't think so. It kind of goes as the usual topic, strong attacks on Hamas and on Hezbollah and on Iran. But I think what was kind of significant for me personally, well, maybe she said it before, but it was like she was calling for kind of a universal declaration or standards for allowing groups to take part in elections worldwide, and like sort of that she's saying that we have to set conditions for any group to take part in elections in any place. Of course, the reference here is to Hamas.
Yeah, I'm guessing they wouldn't qualify by her standards.
Of course, but they wouldn't qualify. But that was kind of interesting thing because I'm sure, you know, if you start applying these standards, I mean, they even historically changed. The group that's there today is Freedom Fighter Another Day. And then, you know, you can mention, I mean, starting with the some Israeli groups themselves before the establishment of Israel in 1948, the British used to consider them terrorists. Now, of course, they became prime ministers later, so, I mean, that's a kind of a dangerous request. I mean, its intentions are clear, but, I mean, setting the standards for elections and, like, you know, who can take part, who can take part on a universal level, I think, is a little bit of an ambitious request, which I don't think is going to get anywhere.
Yeah, and some people say she may be Israel's next prime minister, right?
Actually, she's showing a lot of strength. I mean, and I read a very interesting profile on her. I mean, even knowing from her background, I think she made, in my opinion, as an observer of Israeli politics, she made that kind of shift, you know, from belonging to mostly a Likud family, a kind of a hardline family from a secret service Mossad intelligence background. She's also come a long way to recognize, you know, the two-state solution and that there needs to be an independent Palestinian state. I think she belonged, you know, with her family and background more to the Sharon camp and the Likud camp, but... I hope and I assume, like many Israelis, she's got close to recognizing that there has to be a just, fair solution. Of course, we differ on that solution, but she's got much closer to accepting the concept of two states, which is very positive in my opinion.
You mean you differ in terms of like where the boundaries would be drawn and things like that?
Sure, the boundaries, the refugees issue, the issue of Jerusalem. These are the tough issues, of course. It's not just enough to say that you accept a Palestinian state. First of all, we want it very fast. I think many people in the Arab world think that, and I think even Arab governments, you know, that was part of the story that we covered this year, this week for the General Assembly, that, you know, the conference that President Bush has called for in November, people are saying, hey, we've had so many conferences before this time, we need some assurances that this conference will be serious. You know, the Arab side, the Palestinian side, they want the conference to discuss final status issues, the same issues I just told you about, borders, Jerusalem, refugees, while, of course, the Israelis want to continue to reach a more general framework. Mrs. Livni just said common ground of political understandings. You know, these kinds of diplomatic language, you know, which means that don't expect something big out of November, and of course the Palestinian and Arab side are pressing for some serious results with timetable, and you know, because I mean, to be honest, Bob, I mean, even for me personally, I've almost spent my entire professional career covering the Palestinian-Israeli talks. I know for sure there are like hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of agreements. You just need the political will and the push, and that's what I hope will come out from the November meeting in Washington, hopefully.
Yeah, one idea I've heard lately is that what needs to happen is that various outside actors, certainly including the United States, need to get together and get very clear on what they think a just solution would be and actually present it to the Israelis and the Palestinians, because that would give the Israeli politicians cover in terms of domestic politics. In other words, you know, if you're asking for more land, then it would be easy for an Israeli leader to sell to the Israeli people. It's useful for that leader to be able to say, look, the U.S. is, you know, is pushing for this, and this really wasn't my idea, but this is the thing that's on the table, take it or leave it.
Well, like, you know, from my reading from, and I think also the reading of the American administration, but my reading of Mrs. Levine's speech, she was just saying right now that any solution has to be bilateral. And that's, again, one line which I think the United States also follows. I mean, that any solution has to be reached by both Israel and Palestinians. Israel, of course, is more aware in recent years of the international pressure on it, you know, to reach a peace deal. But the question is, again, you know, I mean, lots of people who are very suspicious and they are, well, this is probably President Bush's last year in office. Usually the last year in the history of American presidencies is not the most productive. You know, I mean, President Bush has a lot of problems in Iraq. Now there are a lot of fears of what might happen in Iran. So, I mean, there are a lot of people who are suspecting, actually, that even the administration, the Bush administration, is pushing for something really, really big. You know, actually, you know, there are some cynics, you know, who say that whenever the United States wanted kind of to launch a war of some sort, they revived the Palestinian-Israeli track, which is, you know, I mean, you can have some evidence to support that, because in 1991, for example, when the United States wanted the widest participation possible in the war to oust Saddam from Kuwait, they made the Madrid Peace Conference in 1991, and with the participation of all Arab countries, Again, shortly before the Iraq War started, the recent one in 2003, President Bush came in the Rose Garden and announced his vision of two states, and that the roadmap came, and after that we had the Iraq War. So some people are asking, are we going to have another Iran war? And that's why Bush is seeking to revive the Palestinian peace process to attract some Arab support, because again, we're hearing the argument, you know, that maybe if Bush moved forward the peace process, he can get some more support from the Arab countries, and the obvious, you know, growing signs of possible confrontation between the United States and Iran. So we'll have to wait and see. I mean, the coming few months will be very telling, I assume, the coming 6 months, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah, well, I remember before they launched the Iraq War, the administration was saying, you know, the road to peace in Jerusalem leads through Baghdad, but I don't think the dynamic you're describing is what they had in mind at that point. But anyway, you know, this reminds me of a comment we got after our last and only previous dialogue from a commenter named Conscious Cat. At least that's the username. As I recall from earlier comments, he or she, I think, is an Israeli. I may be wrong, but it was a question for you. She says that it is, according to my limited understanding of Islam, giving up, letting the Israelis keep Israel proper, that is, even the pre-1967 borders, Israel, is something that is utterly unacceptable to the mainstream of the world's 1.2 billion Muslims, because it is all of the land belongs in Dar al-Islam, that is the House of Islam, and a truce or armistice, a hudna, is fine, and Hamas is constantly offering them, but only until Muslims become sufficiently strong to retake the lands.
I understand where the reader is coming from. I don't think this is the mainstream, you know, and I assume that the questioner, he or she, as you said, you know, probably, I mean, if she's coming from Israel, knows very well that I can speak of many Israeli groups or Zionist groups, Jewish groups, that kind of believe in a certain vision of Israel as being the promised land, as being the land which is only belong to the Israelis. You know, they have a very religious vision of the state of Israel, and I think that exists on the Israeli side and exists on the Muslim side or the Arab side, if you might want to put it this way. But I know this argument, of course. That's the arguments of the political Islamic groups. That's the argument of groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, like Hamas. They say that we cannot give up this land because this is old and all Muslim land. That's one line of literature that exists, you know, no doubt. But I very much doubt that this is mainstream. And I think also you can tell by, and that's an argument that I always try to make, that on realities on the ground, even groups like Hamas, you know, they know that if a state existed within the border of 67, I think they will be very much under pressure to accept the solution of the two states and to go ahead with it. But it has to be a real state. You see, that's the problem. A state, we have to reach a point where we say, okay, we're going to stop building settlements. We're going to release the Palestinian prisoners. We're going to reach a solution on the issue of Jerusalem, which is very, very sensitive, of course, as you might know and as our viewers would know. And we have to work on the issue of the refugees. These are like sorts of four issues that we have to reach a genuine solution about them. And from there, if the state becomes a reality, if Palestinians become like recognized nationals like everywhere else in the world with a passport, with the ability to control their borders, to import and export, I think at that point, I think, you know, I'm almost sure as an Arab and Muslim myself that the vast majority, 70-80% maybe even higher, would support that two-state solution. Will you have the literature that exists for hundreds and thousands of years, 1,500 years, that says this is the land of Islam versus the land of Judaism? Yes, of course. You know, you will have it in the Jewish side, you will have it in the Muslim side. But I hope these are not the ones who are, you know, calling the shots, as we say.
Yeah, and then the question becomes, among those who don't accept the solution, how many want to express their discontent violently, and can the violence be controlled by the Palestinian side and so on? But, you know, we should...
Bob, if I just might follow up quickly on this.
Sure.
You know, let's look at the Egypt model. You know, Egypt model. Egypt is a major Muslim country, 70 million people. We had our peace treaty with Israel in 1979.
Right.
And this peace treaty remains alive until now. And if you talk to... I'm sure the majority of Egyptians, what they want the peace to continue. Because like I said last time, peace means allowing us to take care of our economic development, about, you know, education, about, and all the other issues. So Egypt is a good model to show you're the person or the man or the woman who asked this question, that people in the region, in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, they are ready to coexist, but we have to reach that, you know, defining moment where we stop arguing, you know, in conferences and stuff like that. I think that the borders of the solution are very clear. There's tons of literature on that, many initiatives by peace groups from both sides, from even officials. So it's time to make a genuine move, you know, and regardless of what's going to happen after that.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated, and maybe we'll get back to this, but because of you may have to run at any moment, I wanted to ask you, the big story coming out of the UN, where you are, in America, has during this the General Assembly meeting, has been Ahmadinejad's appearance and also his appearance at Columbia University. I'm wondering, first of all, has that been the biggest story for your Arab audience?
Of course. I mean, Mr. Najad has been a story since he came last year, actually, especially that when he came last year and delivered a very hardline speech at that time. And we also had the Chavez, Hugo Chavez speech last year, when he said he smelled the smell of sulfur after Bush speaking. Of course, Hugo Chavez did not come this year, but the Iranian president came. He started the controversy early by this proposal to go visit Ground Zero, you know. So, I mean,
how did that play in among Arabs, do you think?
Actually,
I mean, did the refusal to let him go there help him in Arab public opinion?
Well, like, you know, it's such a big responsibility for me to speak on behalf of all the Arabs, you know.
It's a job somebody's got to do.
Yeah, but, like, I'll try. I think, to be honest with you, I think, again, there are a lot of problems between Iran and the United States dating back to the 1979 resolution.
Or some would say the 1953 coup, but anyway.
Yes, of course. That's what I was going to just say. I mean, that's from the American side. It dates back, I mean, at least the modern days, you know, dates back from the days of the hostages, the people blindfolded coming out from the embassy, you know, allegations and accusations that Iran has been involved in certain acts that led to the death of American soldiers. So that's where the American background comes from. The Iranian side, as you mentioned yourself, they have a lot of grievances that date back to 1954, when they believe the CIA involved to overthrow a very nationalist Iranian prime minister, Mr. Mossadegh, because he dared to nationalize the oil industry there. So they have that, but even if we move to the recent, you know, the Iranians, I think, in my understanding, just as a political observer, after the revolution, they have a very big grudge, if we might say. I mean, of course, that's the lightest you can say. They have a very big problem with the U.S. for supporting Iraq, the former same regime of Saddam Hussein, which now the, you know,
for supporting him, and then
at that time, America was basically the main supplier, you know, for Mr. Saddam Hussein to fight against Iran.
Yeah.
So the Iranians do not forget this at all, and they have a grudge against that. And since then, lots of sanctions, lots of things. So the matter is complicated. But again, let's be objective about it. I'm sure even no one would deny this if you go and search the internet. The Iranian government at that time, in 2001, I think President Khatami was in office at that time, he was the first one to issue a condemnation for the September 11 attacks. And I think, again, in Iran, they were, like, I was personally surprised to see a vigil that was held there in kind of sympathy with the victims of the September 11, you know, the people who died in this very tragic accident. And later, even more than that, if you would go back to the books written by Mr. Tenet, by some key diplomats who took part in the preparation for the war against the Taliban in Afghanistan in 2001, October 2001, Iranians were very helpful. That's official.
They helped. There's been criticism from the American side that we failed to take advantage of opportunities to forge a kind of alliance with Iran. But one thing I'm particularly interested
in... Also, with the entire Arab world at that time, because there was a lot of sympathy, but I was just saying, I'm mentioning all this background to say that, you know, the Iranian, Mr. Najad, you know, comes and makes this request. I think he has all this background in mind. But, of course, you know, he should have also predicted that he knows how his image is right now in the West. He's been villainized big time because of his statements on Israel, because of his statements on the Holocaust, because of his stands on the nuclear issue. He's been villainized, and I think he knows that. So I think it was a little bit of a, you know, I don't know why he had made this request personally. I think it was a little bit over the edge personally.
Well, do you think he almost would welcome being denied. I mean, and it also gets at this
appearance. I think it played in his hands. I think it was silly, actually, to not to let him go and to have all this. I mean, if he had gone, I mean, I think he was expecting this, and he wanted to say, look, guys, I'm going to go express peace, and now they're preventing me from doing this.
Okay, well, here's my question. It also pertains to his appearance at Columbia University. With both of these things, the denial of his request to visit the 9/11 site and the way he was introduced, I would say, less than graciously at Columbia University.
Very rudely, I might say.
Yeah. A lot of people have argued here that both of those things probably helped his standing in Iran. And my question is how they played out in the Arab world. Because, you know, Americans... Some Americans kind of tend to think, well, there's us and then there's like all those Muslims. But as you know, it's more complicated than that. There are a couple of divides between many Arabs and Iran. One is that the Arabs are Arabs, the Iranians are Persians. Another is that most of the Arabs are Sunnis, the Iranians are mostly Shia. So
yes.
It's not a given that Arabs would line up with Iran or Ahmadinejad on any given issue. But I'm curious, is it your sense that, for example, the way he was treated at Columbia actually helped his standing in the Arab world, not just among Iranians?
I think to an extent. You see, Nejed, and despite all these important factors that he mentioned, the differences over being Arab versus Persian, the differences over Shia versus Sunni, I think he has a kind of a constituency or a popularity of some sort in the Arab world because of his rhetoric, you know, because of his stands in Israel, because of his defiance of the West, because, you know, he's like the Chavez of the Muslim world, you know what I mean, one way or the
well,
other.
Well, and in fact, doesn't Chavez himself have a pretty high standing among many Muslims
of course,
because of the
of
way
course.
He stands up to George Bush, or is that
but
wrong?
I have to tell you something, and that's maybe a point that we raised before. You see, this administration, unfortunately, does not want to see the realities on the ground all over the world, and that the opposition to its policies, to its war in Iraq, is not only limited to the Muslim and Arab world. It's in Latin America, it's in Asian countries, it's in, like, maybe Canada, I think, as well. I mean, it's not just people do not want another war. And that's why there is a lot of worry and maybe even some sympathy with the Iranian regime right now, despite all its oppression. It's not a democratic regime. Nobody can argue about that. But still, you know, people do not want to see another war. And that was the main concern and worry among many observers of this year's General Assembly. When President Bush gave his speech, people, like, you know, were waiting and to see what he's going to do, because it was here in September 2002, if you remember, that he came basically and kind of, you know, made the first shot at the Iraq war. You know, he fired the first bullets, you know, when he said, issued a warning to the Iranian regime. We were expecting President Bush to come and do something like that with the Iranian regime. He did not. But even then, you know, people are not very comfortable because of the statements coming from the French, because of the military movements that are taking place.
Yeah, France is now pro-war this time. I mean, the leader
it's
is
amazing.
Talking pro,
it's
more
amazing.
Militant. Well, the French political leadership, different people have said different things, is talking
exactly.
Much more militantly about Iran than they were talking about Iraq before the Iraq war.
Of course, I was very surprising, Bob, you know, how the French, in a way, you know, kind of replaced the British, the role that the Prime Minister Tony Blair was playing, you know, I mean, the British delegation this time was very low-key, and, you know, and you've seen that the French were the ones in the center stage. Of course, the fact also that France is the president of the Security Council for the month of September helped a lot, you know, in having Sarkozy and Kushner, his foreign minister, in the center stage, yeah.
Although Sarkozy himself has lately, I think, downplayed the military angle on Iran, but...
Of course. I just hope that the majority of world opinion can see the existing big mess.
Well,
that's a very kind word to say in Iraq, so nobody wants another war in Iran, you know, at least in the coming year. I mean, this is a huge nightmare for me.
Well, really. Tell me, how would it play out in the Arab world, again, to oversimplify, in the realm of Arab public opinion, if the U.S. did, you know, not invade Iran, but bomb it extensively, trying to
very
take out the nuclear program?
Kids.
Or if Israel did, and also, does it matter really whether it's Israel or America?
I can't even think of the consequences. The consequences are going to be so disastrous. And just I am a reporter. After all, I only read and hear what other officials say. The possibility of the United States invading Iran, forget it. You know, already the United States, like doing an Iraq scenario, the United States has I think I was just reading an article about the Defense Secretary's plans to expand the army, and right now the United States has something like 526,000 soldiers. You have already almost 250,000, and maybe more, you know, kind of stuck in Iraq. You know, in order to be able to do a country like Iran, you will definitely need at least 500,000, 600,000 soldiers, and I'm not a military expert.
Well, but I think one scenario is just a bombing and not an invasion.
Yeah, exactly. So let's include the invasion. But even the second scenario of this constant or non-stop bombing, which the United States tried in with Iraq in 1991 and with Yugoslavia in 1998, you know, a sustained bombing campaign for 30 days or something. Because I don't think that the Americans, if they want to kind of cripple the Iranian regime, I don't think they know more than that it needs more than four or five, six strikes in very particular places, and that's it. So, I mean, what I've been reading, at least, that it's going to do something is going to be kind of what they call carpet bombing for a sustained period of time.
Well, but one scenario is that the goal would be to just take out the nuclear program. Now, it may be that a lot of people are saying they're wrong and they
very
can't
difficult.
Do that from the air, but one scenario is a more limited set of bombings, possibly combined with covert action on the ground, mm-hmm, you know, special mm-hmm. forces, but mm-hmm. something short of an invasion.
You see, Bob, the problem with the limited thing is that I think, at least that's on my own analysis and reading again from people, if it's a limited strike, you know, I mean, the United States knows that the Iran is going to respond harshly, whether to a limited or whether to a major.
So
if you have a limited strike, Iran is still, and of course the Iranians now, the stakes are being heightened. You know, the French Sarkozy speaking of a war and saying it, you know, saying the word itself is terrifying. But if the French speak, he said, you know, there are 160,000, 70,000 soldiers that are now U.S. soldiers in Iraq is on our target range. The U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan is in their target range. The oil industry is in the target range. Lebanon is into their target range. I mean, you're speaking about disasters that are going to happen all over the region, even by just simply going and doing a limited strike to four or five positions, which in my reading or what I've been reading about this topic is a very difficult thing to do because the Iranians are not stupid. They've scattered all their positions, their nuclear sites, whatever you want to call them, in very scattered places. There's a lot of talk of tunnels. So I'm sure, I mean, intelligence people know tons and tons more than I do about this. But I mean, I'm just hoping, and I'm hoping very much that in this coming year that President Bush has in office, he won't leave another disaster to his successor. And I don't know, I'm just watching the Sunday talk shows yesterday, and even Republican senators do not seem to be any keen at all to see another war. And even what you read in the press, and I'm sure your audience read it, even the Pentagon, inside the Pentagon itself, the army people wouldn't very much support this kind of military action towards Iran.
Okay, let me ask you a related question about the possibility of Iran getting a nuclear bomb. Now, I know leaders of Arab states are not enthusiastic about that.
Sure.
How is that prospect perceived, though, by Arabs kind of on the street, the Arab populace more broadly?
Yeah. We have a very kind of common understanding, you will find it among Arab, you know, public opinion, and I can definitely speak for that, which is our main concern as Arabs, I assume, is the Israeli nuclear issue. We know that Israel has nuclear weapons for a very long time, since the maybe late 50s, being helped with the French and later with the U.S. administrations. So it bothers a lot of Arabs. It bothers a lot of the Arab public opinion. This is what they see as the double standard. Why should Israel be allowed to kind of have nuclear weapons and not even subject to inspection? Nobody's pressuring Israel to join the nuclear non-proliferation treaty like you're doing with the rest of the world. You know, the rest of the world is being asked to join, but Israel is not even asked to join. You know, they're maintaining this kind of policy, and there is a kind of an attitude towards this that Israel, from the American point of view, from the European point of view, is a responsible country. So, I mean, we trust them with nukes, but we don't trust the Arab side with nukes. So this means, this makes a lot of people angry, and that's why on the popular opinion, the public opinion level, you will find people sympathetic with Iran, with Pakistan, with third world countries possessing the technology, because we feel, why should this technology be manipulated or monopolized only by the West? And at the same time, why nobody's putting our concern towards Israeli nuclear issue into consideration too? But of course, I mean, I assure you, there are some Gulf countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, you know, man, maybe Kuwait and Bahrain and United Arab Emirates, these leaders, they come here and they say openly that they believe Iran is a threat because Iran is the major dominant power in that region. And, you know, Iran basically can do whatever it wants in this region except if these countries were protected, you know, by the United States. So I think these countries are very much neighboring. The Iran in the Gulf region, oil-rich countries, are very worried by the Iranian. And they were very worried from Iraq.
But does that include the people or just the political leadership? I mean, I know it includes some people, but how many? I mean, how much of the country, the populace, is actually upset about that?
Upset about the nuclear?
About the prospect of Iran having nukes.
I'll tell you something. I mean, I think, really, to be honest, Bob, the people are far more concerned on the possible consequences of a military confrontation between the United States and Iran more than being concerned about the issue of the Iranian nuclear issue. I mean, I don't think on the short term, first of all, Iran is going to get nuclear weapons because if you trust the CIA assessments, the European Western assessments, they believe not even before 2010, 2015. And, you know, even if they have it, whom are they going to use it against? You know what I mean? I don't think they are planning to use it against Israel. I mean, forget about all the rhetoric.
Well, some of Ahmadinejad's rhetoric has not been reassuring there, but anyway.
Yes, I believe me.
I don't think he would launch a first strike against Israel personally,
indeed.
But if he really wanted to minimize
concern.
If
he does this, he knows he's not a crazy guy in the Iranian. He's only one member of a big Iranian regime. And the Iranians, if they do something like this, they know that this means that they've opened the doors of hell.
Yeah, I don't think
the United States goes afterwards and drops a nuclear bomb on the Iranians, if they nuke Israel, I mean, I don't think anyone will be surprised.
Right, the Iranian president does not have as much power as the American president has.
And the Iranians, I'm sure you would speak to experts on the Iranian issues, you know, they're very pragmatic people, and they won't go that far. And if they wanted to go that far, they have done so a long time ago. You know what I mean? So you can think of the worst nightmare scenarios and go on the basis of those nightmare scenarios and kill 500,000 more people. I don't think so that this should be the case.
You brought up Israel's nuclear arsenal. Let me ask you this hypothetical. Now, I think one thing that is not within the realm of possibility is Israel disarming along a nuclear dimension.
Nobody wants Israel to disarm. We want it to join the NPT and to open its installations for an inspection like any other.
So that's my question. That's my question. What I had in mind is, suppose Israel did the following. They said, look, we hope that someday the whole Middle East will be a nuclear-free zone. And in fact, that's the premise of the whole NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
The whole world NPT, of course.
Is that supposedly we're moving toward disarmament. And suppose they said, now, of course, well, we don't, for obvious reasons, we feel that we cannot be secure and disarm at the moment. However, we would be willing to even shut down the reactor. I mean, supposedly they have a couple of hundred nukes. I mean, plenty as a deterrent.
Yes.
And they might even go further and say, we will even decommission 10 nuclear warheads, whatever. So if they did something that was designed to be a major show of goodwill and say, here's what we will do.
Will happen in my lifetime.
But suppose. I mean, because this is the kind of thing that it actually seems to me it would be in Israel's interest to do
of course.
You compare it to such alternatives as bombing Iran. And let me just finish the thought. So Israel says, okay, we're going to keep our nukes, but we will let you inspect our reactors, confirm we're not making any more. They might even shut down reactors, whatever. And, we will do an accounting so that somebody will know whatever, how many we have or whatever. But they would keep the nukes and they would say, in exchange, we do want, you know, real reliable confirmation that Iran is not developing nuclear weapons. So you would have to have an intrusive inspection regime in Iran. Now, my question is, how would that be perceived? Would that do the job in terms of Arab public opinion or whatever? Would that be considered this major concession that really shifted opinion against Iran on this issue of on the nuclear issue?
Unimaginable. That would be an unimaginable compromise. I think that's really what I think Arab officials and governments tell the U.S. officials. They're not even going as ambitious. You are very ambitious by saying disarm or things. You know, all that's demanded from Israel is the recognition and join the NPT and to allow its installations for inspection. I think that will be a major, you know, major kind of leverage on behalf of the United States
to win
the
entire. So they can keep their nukes with an overture like this and do even less than I outlined. In other words, not decommission any of them, and yet still sway opinion dramatically in their direction, you think, so that then the pressure would be very much on Iran.
Yes.
To change its tune.
I want to tell you again, you know, that would be, again, I'm telling you, I can't even imagine what you're talking about. You know, we're not even getting a recognition. We're not even getting a request from the U.S. or European governments to ask Israel to join the NPT. So, I mean, that which is a very expected and normal step. All countries in the world, almost, except for India, Pakistan, and a few others, but most countries, I mean, the majority, 99%, I think, of countries joins the NPT. So, I mean, why not Israel? Why should it always be given this exception? We want to normalize the situation in the region, and we do not feel safe as Egypt, as Syria, as Jordan, as, you know, Lebanon, the countries neighboring Israel, that we can have Israel nuked up to the teeth. And we feel safe about it because we want at least some outside party and to go and to observe and to tell us what's going on there. And then, of course, that will help Iran. But again, I want to put into consideration, but we're not talking about producing orange juice. We're talking about producing nuclear bombs. And as far as I have read, and I've read quite a reasonable amount on that, this is not an easy technology, and even if you get the nuclear fuel, it's not easy to get the design of the warhead, and even if you get the warhead, it's not easy to get the missile that you're going to use. A lot of technology, very expensive, within the existing restrictions and all close monitoring that the United States is having. I mean, I don't know. And even if worse comes to worse and they manage to obtain what they would expect to be the smallest sort of existing nuclear device, I mean, again, of course, it will give them some major deterrence. Lots of Arab countries won't be happy in the region, particularly the Gulf ones. But again, I don't think that the Iranian regime is that much irresponsible that it will kind of think or consider or even except if they are, again, I can't even think of a situation why they would use this. But not get me wrong, Bob, I totally understand why people get very worried when they listen to the Iranian president that, okay, fine, I know personally as an Arab, that's a kind of a literature and a school flow that exists, but it does not mean steps on the ground. But of course, people who hear it are totally entitled to be worried and to express this worry. And even in the Arab press, I assure you, some people, I'm not saying a lot of people, but some people are asking the Iranian president to calm it down a little bit and to be more helpful in creating a peaceful atmosphere rather than, you know, firing these shots and adding more instability.
No, I think the chances are very low that Iran would launch some kind of nuclear strike. It would be very, very, very low. But, I mean, the concern goes beyond that. The concern
is as low as the Bush administration claiming that Iraq, the former Iraqi regime, posed a threat to security after 12 years of sanctions. But
but the concern, I think the more realistic concern is that this would encourage the Arab nations to develop nuclear arms, and even then, I don't expect any of them to launch a unilateral strike. But the more nuclear arms floating around, from an American point of view, the more likely it is that some get in the hands of terrorists and so on. So I think it's a concern. But, you know, back to that plan I was mentioning, where if Israel would just let in inspectors and make this bold overture, it could keep its nukes and possibly shut down any Iranian nuclear weapons program. It is genuinely kind of puzzling to me why no one talks about that, because it seems to me that from Israel's point of view, if the two alternatives to that are either letting Iran have a nuke or bombing Iran with all the negative consequences of that, it seems to me so clearly superior that I just don't understand why nobody's talking about it. And let me just say, I would encourage, if I'm right and viewer Conscious Cat is indeed Israeli, the viewer I mentioned earlier, I would like to ask Conscious Cat if, as an Israeli, do you agree that this seems clearly better than either bombing Iran or, I mean, at least making the gesture? If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You still get credit in the realm of global public opinion. But
believe me, I've mentioned this all the time, you know, to whoever U.S. official, Israeli official I speak to, that if you want to kind of win the hearts and minds on the Arabs and the Muslims and the Iranian nuclear issue, raise this possibility. But, of course, that's really the taboo of all taboos, you know, unfortunately. I have to kind of switch up that.
Yeah.
I have to get that, Bob, again. This is
going from my
headquarters. Sorry.
I'll eavesdrop.
Ayua, upstairs. Sorry. Hi, Bob.
Hi. You have to go again?
I'll have to go basically maximum in 20 minutes because I'm going to go live. I have to record this session in which the Israeli foreign minister spoke.
So you're going to go live on TV in 20 minutes?
Yes.
And do you have any more time you can spend with us, or do you have to go prepare for that?
Well, I'm pretty prepared, so we can spend another maybe 15.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you know, this is the GA week.
I'm grateful for the time that I know this is just about your busiest week of the year.
Thank you.
Tell me, did you interview Ahmadinejad this week? Did you get a chance to do that?
No, we didn't interview him. Our sister channel, Jazeera English, they did interview him. They got like something like 15 minutes of him. The Jazeera Arabic, which I work for, we interviewed the Iranian foreign minister. I personally interviewed Tony Blair. We also interviewed the foreign minister of Syria, foreign minister, and the Arab League secretary general. These are the people we did for interviews.
And what was the next biggest story from your audience's point of view to come out of the UN in the last 10 days, aside from Ahmadinejad and Iran? And leaving aside the Israeli speech that we talked about already that just happened today.
The topic of Darfur was quite important and significant coming out from this meeting.
The topic of what?
Darfur, the conflict in Darfur, of Darfur, because of this plans by the AU and the United Nations to send a total of 26,000 troops there. So that was a topic, you know, because now they are about to get some contributions from some Arab countries, from some African countries, mainly Egyptian, mainly African. All this dispute about the composition of the force, that was an interesting story too. Climate change. There was like kind of some interest, especially that Mr. Ban Ki-moon, this was the first time that he holds a conference attended by maybe almost 80 world leaders and prime ministers and all the kind of high-level officials speaking mainly about climate change.
Is there a lot of interest in that in the Arab world, in climate change?
It is becoming an issue.
I guess they don't want it to get a lot hotter over there, huh?
Of course. There is a recognition. I come from Cairo, for God's sake, of the tremendous amount of pollution that we're getting through. And, you know, people are, you know, noticing it's like kind of a man in the street topic. Isn't it getting hotter than before? You know what I mean? So you always get that kind of questions. And so it is becoming an issue of interest. Yeah, environmentalist issues is also making up. But, of course, you know, the political issues, because that's the reality we live. We live a very sad and violent reality, unfortunately, in our region, in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Iraq, and now in Iran, you name it, in Sudan, in Somalia. So, unfortunately, it's like always, you know, the UN is good and bad because it lets you get to know about lots of world topics, but it also gets you to know how many sad stories exist in our world, unfortunately.
How is this thing in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, or maybe still known as Burma, but how is that playing out in the Arab world? There are, of course, a number of Arabs who would like to see more democracy in their own countries. And we have these democracy demonstrations that have been going on in Myanmar. Has that been getting a lot of attention among Arabs?
We and Jazeera have been covering it. It's not the first topic, but I think it's the third or fourth topic in light of the clashes that were taking place there during the past, I think, 2 weeks or so. Of course, you know, I mean, I'm not sure a lot of people in the Arab world will be following Myanmar out of, you know, it's a little bit far from the Arab world. I don't think there's a lot of background information on it in the Arab world. You know, of course, they know San Suu Kyi, you know, as a world figure who won the Nobel Peace Prize. But I think the attitude maybe sometimes in the Arab world, among in particular countries, would be looking at what's happening in Burma as a repetition of certain, you know, military regimes they are very acquainted with. And that's why they would follow the story with great interest as a, you know, we understand very well what it means to have an army in the street that are running after people and shooting in the air and shooting in people's bodies in this case, too. So that's why I think there's a sort of interest in this story, although, you know, as I said, you know, it's not the number one story, as may be the case here, because I think in the West more people are aware of the situation in Burma rather than in the Arab world.
And what about the Bush speech at the United Nations? Did that, you alluded to that, but did that get a lot of play in the...
We carried it live. You see, because they say Jazeera only carries its own point of view. You see, we carried the entire Bush speech live for 30 minutes.
And what part of it got the most attention among your viewers, do you think?
It's the parts in which he speaks about Iraq, about a little bit about Iran, a little bit about Syria, a little bit about the future democracy project in the region. These were mainly the parts that, you know, the Middle East peace process, people were watching. And as I said, you know, I remember very well when I first went live immediately after the speech, the first thing I said was what was important was what he did not say in the speech. You know, this business that I referred to earlier about not threatening Iran or not giving the starting signal to a possible confrontation, I hope not, with Iran.
Mm-hmm. Now, he complained about the UN's Human Rights Council, complained that
yes.
It criticizes Israel, law doesn't criticize
Mrs.
Iran.
Mrs. Levny just raised the same point, exactly, yeah, that it's mostly criticizing Israel and ignoring other world issues, yeah.
And he didn't mention the Arab world, and I don't know enough about the UN Human Rights Council's record to know about, does it do much in the way of criticizing Arab regimes that are repressive?
I think they do when, like, a resolution or some sort is being presented to them, because I think that the way it works is that all countries of the world have to present reports and follow-ups on their human rights record. But again, I'll tell you my take on this, and of course many of your viewers won't be very happy. I can recognize and understand why, but unfortunately, in the Arab world, we feel that the least we could do when, for example, the Israelis go shoot a missile in Beit Hanun, in this small town in Gaza, and they kill 18 civilians. You know, we have no other option but to go to the Human Rights Council. When the Israelis go and, for example, do blockage or close the Gaza Strip and declare it a hostile enemy territory, you know, people are suffering. So what do? You know, they go to the Human Rights Council. We feel, okay, fine, we're not successful in removing directly the kind of the injustice that they see. So they go to the different international, you know, the panels that are available and existing for them to air their complaints. And I think, you know, if for once the Arabs are trying to use peaceful means or international arenas to express their grievings, you know, other countries should be more active, but you should. I don't think that you can. I don't know. I mean, of course, the council is run by governments. The Human Rights Council is membership of governments, and definitely should do more in several cases. And I'm sure it's totally accurate to criticize it as being a little bit politically oriented when it comes to countries like China, for example. But at the end of the day, I think the Human Rights Council is one place which is left for the Arabs to go and make their complaints and say we want Israel to change its policies.
I know you're about to have to.
Yes, I have 5 more minutes.
Okay, let me. You mentioned our viewers, and I wanted to bring up one thing, which was, last time you talked a little about. I asked you, what did Americans need to understand about the Arab world that they don't? And I think this led to your talking about how we needed to see kind of less disrespect among Americans. And you mentioned things like, you know, calling the Prophet Muhammad a womanizer and things like that. Our viewers, we got a couple of kinds of reaction. Maybe you read some of the viewer comments. Some people said, first of all, they thought that maybe you were misunderstanding the kind of audience you were talking to at the moment, at least in the sense that the average person who watches Blogging Heads TV, you know, has enough sense of decorum to not go around saying the Prophet Muhammad is a womanizer, even though we're the viewers are fairly diverse ideologically. They're not, you know, I think the idea was that they're reasonably classy.
But you wouldn't disagree with me that besides your audience, of course, who might be intellectual, diverse, and classy, as you mentioned, that my sense, you know, is that on the level of the average man in the street, woman in the street, like what we call the lay man and woman, their kind of general understanding of Islam is more of seeing it as an idol religion, which they don't see as being of an equal status of Christianity, or even to that state. You know, some people might respect Buddhism, like I mentioned last time. They might respect Hinduism. They might respect particular religions. But when it comes to Islam in particular, they do not see it. Maybe, of course, I mean, and I don't think you can deny this because of all the associations to so-called terrorism, to the issue of violence here and there. So, I mean, I'm not utterly surprised, but I just wish that, I'm just telling you, when you asked me that question last time, this is one topic where I believe people should be more understanding and we can work more on that issue.
Yeah, no,
it will help a lot.
No, there definitely are a number of Americans who have the attitude you describe. I don't know how many. But another viewer wrote in and made the kind of the point that you could say the same thing about the Arab world. In other words, you speak respectfully about American culture and American religions, but we could equally well point to people in Egypt. And I'll read from the email. This guy says, I mean, I lived in Cairo, and you ought to see what the sheikhs and columnists say about Jews. There's a massive industry that produces the most vulgar form of anti-Semitism, whether it's miniseries, books, columns, etc. And, you know, we don't run cartoons asking kids to become martyrs in the war against Islam, which is a reference to these cartoons.
But they do run cartoons making fun of Arabs and Muslims all the time. And I've seen it in Israeli press, I think, even once.
Press?
Yeah, sure. And even the average Israeli press, the stereotype of the Arab in the Israeli cartoons is not very favorable, I might say. You know? And I want to tell you something, because I know about this. Was a story I covered, because whenever President Mubarak, or particularly Mubarak, when he used to come to America, last time he did it was in 2004, he would be presented with a file by the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, other major Jewish organizations here, with these kinds of anti-Semitic cartoons that they're referring to, and I'm not denying that they exist, you know, and I wish they could change. But also, the last time they met, the Egyptians this time, at least for a change, were prepared, and some of the cartoons that I saw in the Egyptian file presented to the American side, you know, how the Arabs are being portrayed in the Israeli press was not favorable at all. I mean, maybe it does not go as far as, you know, the denying major issues for the Israeli people, such as the Holocaust or being anti-Semitic, but it does show us all as being, you know, stupid, bloodthirsty, terrorist, our beards in a certain way. So, I mean, like, it exists on both sides, and I'm not denying
that. That was the point.
And I'm just saying that you're right. You're right. I'm not going to deny any of what you said. Yes, I want to change the average man's woman and standing here in America of Islam, and of course we have a lot of work to do ourselves in our parts to change the average image or the stereotypes that we have of Jews, Christians, or even Americans. But again, you know, I mean, I'm not being apologetic or anything. Unfortunately, I might tell you this, that the practices of Israel on the ground, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in its surroundings, does not help people like me, secular, who has many Jewish friends who do not really think of this issue as a big matter, to help in changing the public opinion in my parts of the world. You know, when I need something in my hand, you know, to go and argue, listen, guys, we have to change these stereotypes. But unfortunately, when you have very negative pictures, very violent pictures, people getting killed in Palestine, children or whatever, I mean, it's not the time, it will not be right for me to go and speak to my public opinion and tell them, guys, we have to change our attitude. I hope you're getting my point.
Oh, I get that point. Of course, the Israelis say that there are things they need in their hand. I mean, even the moderates and the leftists say it would be a lot easier for them to make the case for generous concessions in a two-state solution if Israelis weren't dying in terrorist attacks.
By missiles.
You know, of course.
But let's think of the rate. Always, let's try to be objective. Like, you know, when we think, when they speak about, for example, the Hamas and Jihad people firing missiles and projectiles from Gaza, over the past maybe 2 or 3 years, maybe about an average, maybe 2 or 3 Israelis were killed in a matter of 2 or 3 years. And you're talking about hundreds of Palestinians
now,
who were killed.
Now, in terms of numbers, it's not symmetrical.
In terms of
numbers,
it tells you. I mean, it's not up to me only. I'm telling you, wallahi, Bob, you know, even here in the United Nations, every time Israel goes kills Palestinian civilians, they say, sorry, it's collateral damage. And in the latest incident, they told them, hey, guys, enough. You know, not every time you go fire in civilian areas and say collateral damage. Don't shoot in civilian areas. Even if you think that there is one guy standing with, you know, one of these little projectiles that they shoot into Israel, causing mainly holes in the street. And by mistake, by mere mistake, of course, they do cause harm to Israelis. But, I mean, I'm sure the Israelis would agree with me that out of 1,000 maybe, or I don't know, even more number of these little missiles that they shoot from Gaza, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 hit any target of any sort.
Yeah, but human nature is such that even quantitatively minor threats like that have a highly unsettling effect.
I won't go argue with it. It's a fair and legitimate thing.
Right.
But I'm just asking you and your viewers to put the other side into consideration. I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to say that I support it. They have to stop. Sure.
I once again, as last time, I end on a note of encouraging mutual understanding.
That's cool.
We can agree on that.